I've been lamenting that I didn't find a way to make this a multimedia presentation. I have a couple of things I could have brought along, but as Michael was doing devotions, it occurred to me that obviously someone above us is being either nailed or screwed or drilled. Something or someone is being crucified. So we don't need what I could have brought. What I could have brought would have been a... let me preface it by saying they would have illustrated one of my primary points, which is that theology of the cross is very hard to explain, but once you get it, you know it when you see it, or you know it when you hear it, even though it's kind of hard to just say all at once. Because the truth is, the center point of it is very simple and very profound, and once you've said it, you kind of have to just sit back and wait until you see it in the works. But what I could have brought was a comic trailer to a film that's obviously never been made. It's something one of my students gave me. It's called The Greatest Action Story Ever Told. And it's a trailer of a film in which some Arnold Schwarzenegger Terminator type figure shows up to rescue Jesus from all his enemies, and Jesus has to keep trying to thwart the attempts of his rescuer. And so this Terminator guy comes along and keeps killing Romans, and over again he shoots Judas, and Jesus keeps saying, "No, we need Judas," you know, and so forth. And I guess he had to be there. Or I could have brought along, on a more serious vein, Emmylou Harris's song "Jerusalem Tomorrow," which is a song in which you hear the voice of someone who talks about this wonderful person that she's just met, and here's all the things that they're doing. My goodness, we're feeding the multitudes. The lame are walking, the lepers are cleansed, and so on, and we're going to take over the world. And now he says, we're going to Jerusalem tomorrow. Just a bit of irony. No, I can't. You got to listen to Emmylou. Do it. Anyway, it's if not foolhardy, it could even be dangerous to expound upon theology of the cross. Luther got tossed for it, and St. Francis, long before Luther articulated it, lived it, and mostly just got co-opted by the powers of the church. And most people who work and live by it mostly just get ignored. It all begins, I would say, with a question that is very like the question of our that this year's theme verse answers. Our theme verse is, "I am with you always," which is an answer to a question, "Where is God? Where is the risen Christ?" I've been talking about that question up here. As partly the question as Elie Wiesel asks it in his famous little Holocaust memoir, Night, when he tells the story of the hangings of the three saboteurs one afternoon, and the one is a child whose weight isn't sufficient to make the noose work properly, and so the child twitches and hangs there for half an hour between life and death. And someone in the crowd asks, in the camp that's been made to stand there and watch, "Where is God now?" And the voice inside Elie Wiesel says, "They're hanging on that gallows." And that's exactly what we say as Christians, but we don't mean it exactly as Wiesel did, but that's our answer. Where is God? There, hanging on that tree. And the theology of the cross, as Luther attempted to articulate it, is precisely, in some ways, nothing more and nothing less than saying, if you want to see God, that is where you look. there and only there in a way. Luther got to that point not so much by asking where is God in a world of suffering, but he asked it by being a fairly honest person about himself and his own capacities, the limitations on his intellect and on his efforts as a pious person who hopes somehow to please God and to serve his fellow human beings. His question was ultimately, well, he asked it in German, but in English, it's, where can I find a gracious God? So again, he was asking a where question, and the answer to his question is, I can only find that gracious God on the cross. I can't find that gracious God anywhere else. And translated into a hermeneutic of the scriptures, for example, if you go looking for that, as Luke tries to teach his readers to do with all those Bible classes at the end of Luke's gospel, where Jesus goes around saying, if you look for a suffering Messiah, you find it all over the Hebrew Bible as well, in the Law and the Prophets, all can bear witness. If you go looking at the Christian scriptures as well, that's what you find. It's precisely the way Jesus died that makes the ultimate moment of revelation happen in the Gospel of Mark, when the first person in the whole book to witness, testify that this was the Son of God without benefit of demon possession is the centurion. And that's all he saw, was how this man died. That's theology of the cross. And when John's gospel over and over again says that the moment of glorification is the moment of the crucifixion, and that Jesus dies crying, it worked, it is finished, it's accomplished, that's theology of the cross. And Luther found the theology of the cross corroborated there in the scriptures. Now, beyond that, in some ways, I find it nearly impossible to say what the theology of the cross is. It's much easier to say what it's not. It's not triumphalism. It's not ideology, and so forth. But I will try. I'll offer a few theses, as it were, in Lutheran fashion. And I will trust that my colleague over here to my right, whom we just heard from, he of the turgid ontology, that he will keep me honest and supplement and amplify whatever of my observations turn out to be ontologically challenged, that is, dead in the water. So Michael, you must help as you see fit. So here are my own theses on theology of the cross. First of all, the obvious one that I just said, and this is the center. If you want to see God, you look to the cross of Jesus Christ, period. In a way, that's the whole point. Theology is talk about God, and theology of the cross is talk about God that begins and ends at the cross. I have a quote from Luther here. The cross alone is our theology. Most people cite the primary source in Luther for his own articulation of that theology in the Heidelberg Disputations of 1518, early in Luther's time as a fledgling reformer. Not too long after having posted the 95 Theses, he was summoned to a disputation with church officials at Heidelberg, and he laid out his theses, and among them are the ones, I actually printed them out and thought I would make them a handout, and then I thought, out of context, I'm not so sure any of you want to be hauling around, you know, numbers 16 through 24 of the theses of the Heidelberg Disputation, so I didn't print it up. You have enough paper, but, you know, I'll just read a couple of these things, and just to give you a sample of how Luther said this thing. It is certain that human being must utterly despair of his own ability before he is prepared to receive the grace of Christ. The person who does not deserve to be called a theologian who looks upon the invisible things of God as though they were clearly perceptible in those things which actually happened. Luther spoke often of the hidden God, and so you don't look at what's obvious. He deserves to be called a theologian, however, who comprehends the visible and manifest things of God seen through suffering and the cross. A theologian of glory calls evil good and good evil. A theologian of the cross calls the thing what it actually is. That wisdom which sees the invisible things of God and works as perceived by man is completely puffed up, blinded, and hardened. The law brings the wrath of God, kills, reviles, accuses, judges, and condemns everything that is not in Christ, yet that wisdom is not of itself, nor is the law to be evaded. But without the theology of the cross, man misuses the best in the worst manner. So see, this is why you don't want to be hauling those around with you. You need to have a class of people to help you understand these things like I do. When I can get together my students and we sit and pound on these for a while. So, back to where we started. If you want to see God, you look to the cross of Christ, not to the law, not to the visible things that you see around you, assuming that these are somehow God or reveal God to you. God, who we see in the cross, is, for example, with us in the most wretched moment of human misery, failing, and cussedness. That's what the crucifixion is. A way that Douglas John Hall states it is this, in a book that I'm going to tell you about in a moment. The world is full of pain. God loves the world. Only by joining the world in its pain can God love the world. That's one way to articulate the theology of the cross. To fix the world would not be to love it, but to make us automatons, puppets, and incapable of love. And if you ever want to work on that, on the theology of the cross from that angle, you just spend a long time studying the stories of the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness. The temptations to fix the world by making sure everyone is fed, everyone gets their 70 years and 10, and there is peace on earth. That would be to fix the world, and that's what everyone expected the Messiah to do. But no, Jesus goes off and gets himself crucified instead of doing what all the world expected of a Messiah. All theologies that look elsewhere for a starting point besides the cross result in triumphalism and or ideology and or crushed naivete in the face of ambiguity. Even if we look at resurrection and at happy endings, we deny reality and seek a religion of vindication. That's a thesis. By triumphalism, I mean a religion in which we expect that everything needs to turn out right. And we get vindicated, and we are proven right. A theology whose goal is to get all the people who are right to heaven and all the people who are wrong to hell is not a theology of the cross. That's both ideology and triumphalism. A theology that only looks at nature is one of those that is flawed by looking at things that are ambiguous and expecting to see God in them. I borrow this line from Michael. It's not actually my own. If we look in the wrong places, if we look, for example, primarily to nature to find our God, then we'd better ask ourselves, how long really do we want to be suckled by Mother Katrina as she visits Louisiana? And exactly how much does the earth care for us when it sends us tsunamis and treats the human race as though it's a bunch of ants on an anthill that some kid pours a bucket of water on? That's the God you get when the God that you're looking for is the one that you see primarily or perhaps only in nature. Thesis 6. Theology of the cross seeks virtues of faith, hope, and love. Alternatively, theology of glory seeks the virtues of sight, finality, and power. So the pairings are, it's faith, not sight. There is no way finally to know.
Can you say it again?
Instead of faith, hope, and love, that's what theology of the cross seeks, the virtues of faith, hope, and love. The theology of glory seeks the virtues of sight, finality, and power. So we finally want certainty. We want to see, not just believe. We want to be certain and be final about things rather than living in hope. And we want power, not the vulnerability of love. The theology of glory finds the first and last words of about God as power, supremacy, and authority. The theology of the cross finds the ultimate words about God as compassion, mercy, grace, and benevolence. From here on, it gets a little trickier. A theologian of the cross, at least this is according to the scholars about it, theologian of the cross doesn't talk about the cross. The theologian of the cross only proclaims the theology of the cross. Theology about the cross is all the doctrine stuff we do that talks about what the cross must mean. But the theologian of the cross, and not simply a person who talks about the cross, knows that all formulations, all attempts to explain the cross in human language are formulations and thus icons and potential idols. All of them are flawed. Part of the theology of the cross is to recognize that all of our God talk is limited and by nature flawed because we made it. And therefore, it may contain some truth and it may help us explain what we mean to each other, but it's all dangerous because it's all potentially an idol. Because we can mistake it for the real thing, or as I like to tell my students, we can so easily mistake the map for the territory. The contextual nature of theology makes every good icon of one age a potential idol in the next, for one thing. If all we do is keep passing on the same language about the cross over and over and over again, then we have attempted to contain the crucified God in a particular kind of box that maybe someone else can't understand. And so you can never say, as the theologian of the cross, now I've got it right. Once and for all, this is it. Now we've got it explained. We can't say that about anything. Now we've got it right. And Luther actually says that it's in that very moment that we think we've got something right, either a theological formula or some deed in our lives, that we are at the most dangerous and vulnerable point in our lives, because then what we're actually saying is, well, at least for this Christ needn't have died. now I've done something that's perfect. Now I've got something that's not flawed that I can justify. And we can't ever say that. The Lutheran way of putting a guard against our putting things in reserve that are beyond the need of Christ's death is to say that we know we have gospel when it honors Christ's death by treating it as absolutely necessary and absolutely sufficient. There needs to be nothing more. And if you want to look for a locus for that teaching, it's Apology 4 of the Augsburg Confession, which Melanchthon wrote to try to explain the theology of the Augsburg Confession. And in Apology Article 4, he in effect gets out his toolbox and says, these are my tools for telling when I have it more or less straight. If I have honored Christ's death by speaking of it as completely necessary and also completely sufficient, if that's how I talk about the cross, then I have it straight. Now we must talk about the cross, that is, about the cross. That is, we must have doctrine. But doctrine is only appropriate and necessary to the extent that we need to find ways to make sure that our good news remains good, that our language is checked to see if we're actually honoring Christ's death as necessary and sufficient. 9. Proclaiming the crucified Christ and living out of the theology of the cross leads to suffering discipleship and what Douglas John Hall calls ecclesia crucis, a church of the cross. But suffering is not the object of discipleship, nor does the theology of the cross say that suffering is good, as I'll get to in a moment. But rather, suffering is the inevitable consequence of following a theology of the cross. If you follow a theology of the cross, it leads you to love as Christ loves all the way to the cross, and it makes you vulnerable, whether you are an institution or an individual, and likely to be hurt. 10. Theology of the cross does not glorify suffering or say that suffering is good. The charge against theology of the cross from so many people is that all it is a way to tell suffering people that it's good for them and they should put up with it. And they should simply bend over and let their oppressors keep beating them. That's absolutely not the theology of the cross. But the theology of the cross does suggest that suffering is inevitable. If nothing else, we will do it to ourselves. That was Luther's experience. The more perfect he tried to live, the more miserable he became. And if you want to know what the perfect life finally gets you, you just look at Christ. Look what, at least we say he lived the perfect life, look what it got him. That's where life leads. And sooner or later, all of us end up crucified by something or someone, if not ourselves, our neighbors will get us. And if not our neighbors, cancer will get us. And if not cancer, depression will get us. Something will get us. It's inevitable. But it's precisely in the moment that we are nailed that we find ourselves in the company of the crucified Christ. It's not that suffering is good. But it's in that moment that that's where we land, in the embrace of the crucified one. 11. You can never keep theology of the cross straight or get it right, partly because it's by nature counterintuitive and it's against everything that we seek. We seek vindication, as I said before. We seek sight. We seek finality. We seek power, and there's a lot of theology out there that's saturated with God talk and even cross talk, in which the whole point is finally vindication and having a final answer and being right. And there's a lot of theology out there that teaches us that God wants us to be happy and successful, and maybe God does, but that's ultimately a fantasy. I find that I can never keep theology of the cross straight in my own case, because I'm always looking for vindication and I'm always trying to be right and to get it right. Those of you who have been in the village for a few days have heard me talk about my theory about being right, and that it is the fundamental value of humankind, in my estimation, number one on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that human beings love being right more than they love food, water, sleep, even sex. And if you don't believe me, just try living in a lifelong partnership or get married or something like that. As I put it, it's the most effective laboratory I know for proving the human need to be right. And all of our rightness is ultimately going to get crucified. It's just the fact of life. And so our need for vindication and for being right gets in the way of truly understanding and or living the theology of the cross, which is why in my experience I only get it in glimpses. And as you can tell, I have a dickens of a time trying to explain what it is. Theology of the cross does have a high estimate of human capacity and human dignity, but it's also got a totally realistic estimate of human alienation and a sense of God's full and compassionate commitment to bring humankind to full authenticity, which is love and agape. That's a point that I've learned from Douglas John Hall. It appears that theology of the cross despairs of human worth and dignity because it despairs of our capacities for perfection and for rightness. But as Hall points out over and over again in his book on theology of the cross, if human beings were really just a bunch of trash, why would God bother to go to such lengths to be united, to be reconciled, to be joined? It is only for amazing love and the desire to live in companionship with humankind that God would ever do such a thing. And finally, my last little thing, and this is more in the category of how you know it when you see it. Just for example, I think theology of the cross is blasphemy proof kind of stuff, and makes its practitioners blasphemy proof. And here's just an example. You know, there's this crazy stuff going on now about the Da Vinci Code, and there's all these people going around saying what a terrible blasphemy this is. Oh, they've blasphemed Christianity. They're making Christianity look bad. Or when you had the artwork of somebody putting a crucifix in a glass of urine. Oh my goodness, they've dipped a cross in urine. Or when you had that big thing at the New York Museum of Art a few years ago where somebody made a Virgin Mary out of buffalo dung and, you know, dried this buffalo dung and painted it and so on and made a Mary out of it. Oh, they've blasphemed the Mother of God. Oh, goodness. Well, here's what I say to that. After you've been crucified, what else can they do to you? Hurt your feelings? You know, God's been through crucifixion and you dip the cross in your urine? Oh, geez. Or I think about that scene at the end of Luke's Gospel when these two crucified guys are hanging there. One of them says, "Oh, Jesus, you're the king. Can I be your right-hand man?" Jesus says, "Sure. You and me, buddy. Today, we'll go for it." Oh, imagine the soldiers listening to this. These crazy guys hanging on the cross talking about their plans. But we say we are crucified with Christ by baptism into his death. So this is us. We are crucified people. We're talking about our plans. And somebody says something bad to us? Like, oh, you Christians are so stupid. Oh, golly, you know. Like, now you're going to hurt us? You know it when you see it. Crucifixion makes you blasphemy proof. You know, it's hard to humiliate a humble person. And so there's no more need to vindicate yourself. There's no more need to be right about everything. So you're wrong about it. You know, so you're wrong about something. Duh. I think I'll let it go with that and say that I don't know how to finish this. And if there's any time David would allot us, we could talk for a few minutes about all this.
I think we can take as much time as we want. Responses and particularly for how it connects with our mission, what we're about at this place.
Fred, in our culture now of interfaith interactions, ecumenical movements, and you know, you have Buddhist traditions, you have Muslim traditions, and other kinds of things. Where does the theology of the cross come in, and how does it become a stumbling block? Does Jesus become the stumbling block? What's your understanding of that? And I don't know if I'm putting my question correctly or not. But.
Is your question, how do you relate to other religions if you are a theologian of the cross? Mm-hmm. Well, people who work with the theology of the cross can do what some of my colleagues do, and in history of religions field or religious studies, and you know, it's easy enough to as observers and scholars and students of human religiosity to simply compare how do Hindus see God and do theology, or see gods or see the divine or whatever, how do Buddhists do this, how do others do it, how do Christians do it, and do comparative taxonomies of how it all works. If you are engaging in dialogue with people or a person of another religion as a simple believing theology of the cross person, I don't know what you do except say, I see God in this crucified person. Where do you see God? You know, and talk about the various ways that you see God. Now, I know there are forms of Buddhism in which you could find at least some ways that they talk a bit similarly to that. I don't know that you find any of that in Hinduism. I don't know, does that help?
Yeah, I think it does. It becomes obvious, the question, you know, like we talked before about Jesus. What do we do with Jesus when we start talking to other interfaith religions, and where does he, sometimes it becomes a stumbling block.
Yeah. I find it becomes a bigger stumbling block with most other Christians.
Yes. If we really want to talk about Jesus, yeah.
Yeah. By the way, if anybody does, I didn't make this handout. I also had a bit of bibliography. There are many pieces written on theology of the cross. Most of them are out of print. As David reminded me when he asked me to do this, there's a wonderful little Fortress Fascicle book from a generation ago by Reagan Printer,
right,
on Theology of the Cross, and I tried to find one. Even this network on the web of used bookstores didn't have one. But there's a very fine, relatively new book called Cross in Our Context by Douglas John Hall, the Canadian theologian who's made a career out of Theology of the Cross. This is a little distillation of his massive three-volume systematic theology. This is 3 years old, and it's a very fine explication of Theology of the Cross. And then, if you're a little braver, you can try On Being a Theologian of the Cross, Reflections on Luther's Heidelberg Disputation of 1518 by Gerhard Ferdi, the Luther Seminary theologian who died a few months ago. And the one thing that this book does that kind of gives you an entree is he likens Theology of the Cross to a 12-step program, but not in a hokey, cheap way. A fundamental piece of 12-step thought is the first step is that you find your life unmanageable and you yourself have no control. And that's the admission that that one must make in order to be a theologian of the cross, according to Ferdi. That I cannot do a thing to put myself right with God. That God has to do absolutely everything, and that God's way of doing everything is to go all the way to the cross in order to be reconciled.
But I guess I wonder, like, to still Paul Harvey's and the rest of the story, or it seems like I wonder about the questions around, so being a theologian or committed, a believer of the cross and committed to that way of thinking, the part that's, and how shall I then live? You know, what does that mean for my life and our vision and our mission and my own personal commitments? Where does that then take me? Maybe it then takes us as believers a whole variety,
yeah,
of ways, but it seems like that's foundational.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next piece for Christian organizations or individuals is then, how then shall I live?
Well, the little piece that I borrowed from Douglas John Hall and talked about, the ecclesia crucis, the ecclesiology of the cross, the church of the cross. He has another chapter on then what's the point of being a Christian as individuals, and the calling. I mean, in some ways it's very simple. You just heed the call to cross bearing. In the Gospels, if anyone wants to be my disciple, take up your cross, follow me. You save your life by losing it. And those who, you know, those who try to save their lives lose them, and those who lose their lives find them. And so it's in putting oneself at others' disposal in the way that God does, that one serves. That you serve humbly, you serve not assuming that you're right about everything. And from that point on, I can only say, I know it when I see it.
Well, I like what you say about the servant part. You know, then you serve,
yeah,
as you're called.
Right.
The beginning of what you started saying starts to, we can't let people stay in that suffering place. If they're in an abusive situation,
right,
or if they're downtrodden, there's a way to get better.
Mm-hmm.
There's a way to move yourself from that place and figure out how it is that you shall serve. But so many people are, you know, they can't get out of that place, and they hear this theology from individuals that, you know, that's your cross to bear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's such a hard thing to understand, your cross to bear. I'm willing to carry a cross, but I'm not willing to have people flog and beat me. And I mean, I'm not going to stay in that place. We work so hard to get people out of that place. How do we bear a cross, not allow something or someone to abuse us?
Maybe. Well, generally speaking, the enablement of abuse is not truly loving toward the person who's doing this. Mm-hmm. I mean, so at least that much would say that cross-bearing isn't the simple acquiescence in the face of oppression and abuse. I think Martin Luther King kind of got it. And if you read his speeches about how what he's doing is, it's only partly for us. We have to liberate these poor white people from the oppression of their domination. Because they can't be fully human living the way they're living. You know, and we need to be for them. You know, or I think of this amazing book that probably nobody's ever heard of by Lillian Smith called Killers of the Dream. This woman who grew up in the South, in the segregated South, and then wrote a memoir after she realized how that had crippled her. And she writes some absolutely stunning pages about how she came to realize that it was the white people who got crucified. So she didn't use that language, but they were the people that got warped and twisted and pinned to their own prison bars that they had put up to keep other people out. That love of oppressors that King and people like that figure out, that's theology of the cross in practice to me.
Well, one of the reasons that 12 steps are so helpful, I think, is because not only is the theology of the cross not the perpetuation of suffering, but it is also not codependent, which says that I can fix a person's addiction. The codependent person also needs to come to the place of helplessness. So the greater power can work the miracle of redemption. And a lot of times cross-bearing also gets the facade of codependence. That, you know, I'm going to do this for you and I'm going to make you better, which is also not liberating or humble or trusting.
Yeah, theology of the cross is not weakness.
No. And not staying under the burden of something.
But it's also not stomping all over the oppressor and saying, all right, sucker, you were wrong and we're now vindicated and we're on top.
I think we make a misplaced category mistake when we say, when we want to equate something like a theology of the cross, for bearing our cross means we accommodate evil. And bearing the cross is not accommodating evil, saying, oh, that's okay, you know, I have to put up with this abuse. The response to that is, as Fred was indicating there, right, return no one evil for evil. In other words, if evil is done to you, don't respond in evil. But it does not mean stay in abuse, because there's no accommodation. I mean, Martin Luther King Jr. is you call evil, evil. And yet, and as he says in one of his Christmas Day sermons, and in spite of that, you know, you can sick your dogs on us, you can turn on the water cannons, yet we will love you. Right? Now, that's not saying abuse is good, hit me with more water. That's the distinct, because again, to go to Luther's thesis, that would be one who is not calling evil evil and good good, but mixing up the categories. So I think that's what happens there. Second thing to your earlier question, like where do we go with this? Where do I go with this? I think is not quite asking the question in the right way. I think from the perspective of a theology of the cross, you would ask, where is God taking me with this? It's the kind of understanding that quote Paul Ricoeur here. We are not the authors of our lives. We are the narrators. In other words, we usually don't figure out, I mean, by and large, life happens to us. We don't kind of get up every morning and plan exactly what will happen, and indeed that's what it does. But it comes to us, and then we try to put it together, try to narrate it, try to make it an intelligible story and make sense out of it. And in that sense, what a theology of the cross is trying to be the way in which we claim we can make the most sense out of life, although it's complete with paradox. One more aspect, I guess, from what Fred was saying. A component in there is Luther, in his lecture on Romans and elsewhere, talks a lot about hope against hope. And that's a theology of the cross way of hoping. And he gets that hope against hope notion, of course, from Paul, but he also gets that from his studies of the Hebrew scriptures, and again, particularly something like Genesis. He looks to Abraham and Sarah as an example of that, and then says, and that's where Paul gets the idea from as well. He goes back to Genesis 11 and 12, and in Genesis 11, it tells you a little bit about Abraham's ancestry, his marriage to Sarah, and then ends with, and she was barren. And then you go into chapter 12, where God comes along and says, hi, Abraham, it's your lucky day. You're going to have children as populous as sand and everything, and through you all the nations will be blessed. Now, right, there's, Luther would say, hope against hope. Because you're starting out in a condition of barrenness, and yet God is promising all this fertility, if you will, abundance. How can that be? And it's hope against hope, because Luther says the usual way we hope is whatever it is there in the end we desire. Our hopes are that he kind of puts this in means-ends terms, that the means will come through. So in other words, I wake up to say, I want to go on a picnic. I hope it won't rain. I hope the mosquitoes won't be out. I hope it's not too hot. Hope against hope would be, it's raining outside, the mosquitoes are terrible, and it's hot, and you say, I hope I have a good picnic. Now, how can that be? Luther would say, the only way you can have a good picnic at that point is God will bring about a good picnic. Just like, you know, Abraham and Sarah are old, she's barren beyond years. How can you have a great nation? Well, God will bring it about. That's hope against hope. That's what Luther understands the faith of Abraham and Sarah to be. That's what he sees the understanding of faith that's put forward in Paul.
I would put a footnote now to Michael's footnote. You often have to reread the scripture itself with the hermeneutic of the theology of the cross, because at least in my opinion, the whole scripture isn't necessarily theology of the cross. Theology of the cross is a kind of heuristic device, or it is a chosen hermeneutic. It's not the only possibility that exists in Scripture. And one of the texts that I have loved to play with over the years and to look at that sort of illustrates it, that Michael's picnic thing reminds me of, is the lesson in Isaiah that we love. We get it every third year at Easter, and we get it during one Pentecost Sunday during season or during year A when we do Matthew. It's Isaiah 25, what is it, 5 to 9. On this mountain God will set a feast of fat things, of wine well refined and bone marrow and all, you know, the greatest menu in the world. And God will wipe away every tear. The shroud that covers all nations will be removed. There will be no more crying, and so on and so on. And all peoples will rejoice together. This is our God. We have waited for him. He has saved us.
Yay! We made it.
But the very next verse, we all stopped there because we couldn't bear to read what's next. What's next is, but the Moabites will be down at the bottom of the mountain, swimming in our urine and eating our dung. And if they even try to get out, God will squish them down in it, lest they swim away. That's the whole picture. That is the banquet that the world really wants. Us on the top, eating the feast of fat things, and our critics drinking our piss. You know, that's Herod's banquet in the New Testament. That's what we all want for dessert, is the head of our critic on a platter. At Herod's birthday party, that's what you get for dessert. Well, I ask myself, how can I take that full picture as theologian of the cross? And the only way I can do it is to say, where in that picture do you put the crucified Christ? And the only place I can put the crucified Christ, the only place I can put even the uncrucified Christ, is down at the bottom of the mountain, swimming with the Moabites, because, of course, you know, there is old Ruth back in his genealogy, the Moabite woman. And I don't know how many generations it takes to purify the blood so that you don't belong down there swimming in the urine. But the only place I know to put the crucified Christ is down there. So if there's a party that any of the rest of us belong to, we crucified folk who were hanging there making our plans with the Jesus of Luke 23, we're at the bottom. Whatever party we're at has to be down at the bottom. And I think that's where Christ's party is. And so we're at the party that may have a lot of mosquitoes and it's hot and all that, and we're swimming in urine, but by God, it's a party. It's a party because Christ is with us, and you should hear us sing. To me, that's theology of the cross, you know, kind of expository fashion. When you take a text and you figure out, what am I going to do with the triumphalism that's even all over the scriptures? I subvert it by means of the cross.
As I was trying to formulate this question, my first question was, is it possible to know or hear the theology of the cross and not live it? And that brought me to the thought of how we need proclamation, so we keep on recognizing it, since we don't really necessarily know it until we hear it. But then there are those long periods when we don't hear it. And I find that so difficult to deal with, you know, those times when we know there's something out there that we need to be hearing, but we're not hearing it, and yet we're trying to, you know, keep on persevering to hear it again. But that brings me back to the original question. Is it possible to know the theology of the cross and not live it?
Well, if you're asking me, it certainly is, because I fail at it all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and exactly as you say, I need over and over and over again to have somebody say it to me again, because it's so against the way I'm truly wired. You know, it's, well, I mean, in Luther's language, you need to be daily crucified. And daily rise to a new life, daily buried with Christ. Because, you know, all I have to do is watch a ball game, and all my other instincts come back. You know, someday I'm waiting for the person who strikes out with two outs in the bottom of the ninth instead of hitting home run to go. You know, because the natural theology that we all know and love is, it's when we hit the home run that God was with us.
Yeah.
You know, bless that woman who did matins this morning, but that was not theology of the cross. It's when God is our bellboy and gets our tickets back that we usually give thanks.
Fred, what do you say of joy?
Joy?
As a theologian of the cross.
You should hear us sing down there in the urine. Just listen to us sing.
I guess, you know, it kind of how things come out of the blue, but I think too that this suddenly makes sense about some of the experiences like in Central America in the 80s, where you were around people for whom their faith was going to mean death, or could. And the joy in that situation is joy that I have never felt anyplace else. Meeting Martin Barreau, one of the five Jesuits who was eventually murdered. And there was a peace and a joy with the full understanding of, you know, what you're talking about. There was sort of a getting to a place, and I think the problem we have is we so rarely ever get to that place of really not having something we can hang on to other than God.
Yeah, and I believe that we can't make that joy happen. That it is finally a gift, and it is the miracle of the Spirit in those places. I mean, I can't account for that.
But just to get back to what I was saying, I think there was something so compelling in that once you hear it that you keep wanting it again. I mean, it was like heroin.
I can't help but notice how where an odd place Holden seems to be in terms of being so inclusive, and it's rather mystified me and confused me as to how can a place such as this exist. In Wisconsin, Christianity doesn't take this form often. Just kind of leave it at that, more conservative. And to be so very, very inclusive, but now it is making more sense with obviously very much be wrong with this, but with the theology of the cross, it seems that inclusivity for people with various handicap, various et cetera, let me go through the list of who's included here, is part of the theology of the cross, that it's almost necessary. If you're loving the enemies, loving the everyone, that therefore theology of the cross, make that necessary. And to quote the new presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, all are welcome at God's table. A woman who was just elected. But does the theology of the cross mandate inclusivity, the welcomeness for the man who wandered through, for the, you know, for the handicapped, for the this, for the obviously gender, and blah 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 blah.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. That going to the cross is according to this theology, God's way of reconciling to any and everyone.
And it, the hospitality doesn't have to be only to people with whom one agrees.
Right.
Yeah. But,
And yet, this is the God we're going to proclaim here. We are going to proclaim the crucified God here. We're not going to proclaim a different God. I mean, Maybe I'm getting off track here, but if we welcome fundamentalists, we welcome nuts like me, we welcome Buddhists, we welcome Hindus, we welcome Druids, we welcome anybody, but we're going to proclaim the crucified God.
But the crucified God is a God who is welcoming of all. Not very from your sitting position.
I think that goes back. I mean, if we put it into kind of that theologian of the cross understanding, there's.
No, keep going.
There's a sense there that, I mean, Fred and I were talking about this the other night. Again, Paul is going to say how Christ died for the ungodly. Unfortunately, what happens in so much of Christian theology is the proclamation that Christ died for the godly. In other words, you got to be in the club and then Jesus will do something for you. The welcoming thing is the recognition that we are all the ungodly. And so, of course, all are welcome because Christ died for all. I mean, another dumb way I always put it is we always have to be wary because often our favorite hymn is Chief of Sinners, though I be, everybody else is worse than me. That'll be in the new hymn. We'll sing it with gusto.
Well, I wanted to go back to one thing Carol had said about we need to hear it over and over. And I feel like what we hear in our society over and over, the theology of triumphalism of, I mean, we label countries evil. We're very blatant about it. And that's what we face every day. And it's discouraging, as Michael said. I mean, to turn on the radio. But I heard Barbara Rossing speak after her book on Revelations. And one point that stuck with me, or question, that how do we as evangelical people make it known that we're thinking other things, that we're not a part of, you know, that we're not a part necessarily of that theology, that we have a theology of the cross, that we, you know, that we have some voice. And I don't see that, I don't see it in our society. I mean, we have it here. It's very small.
Well, I mean, it's not by nature a power-grabbing movement.
And that's her point, you know. You don't go out and yell it out, but I feel like we're...
After 9/11, the whole rest of the world was doing the 7 or 8 R words, retaliation, revenge, retribution, and so on. What are we doing? Repenting. What does that look like, you know?
And so we give it up to God to lead us, as Michael says. What is God? How is it to lead us? But it feels powerless, which is part of the whole thing. But sometimes I feel we should at least, you know, talk about it more at least somehow.
One theologian I know says that it's the difference between power over and power under. And the difference between authority over and authority under. Everyone else seeks power by having authority over people. We seek power through service. You become the servant of all. I mean, that's pretty old Holden symbol. It's just a different kind of power. Looks weak to the world, as Paul says. Looks like foolishness. It is foolish. It's a joke. You know, Jesus Christ, that's a joke. Right there, that's a joke. Jesus Christ, that's laughable. That's the Messiah? You're kidding. or Jesus is Lord, that's a joke too. That's why I hate the loss of the word Lord up here, because it's one of the best old jokes there is. Jesus is Lord. I mean, it was a joke on the empire is what it was. It, that's what the empire made you say. Caesar is Lord. And the Christian said, no, Jesus is Lord.
The crucified guy, you're out of your gourd.
And unless you understand that it's a joke on the world, it's just kind of hard to get. It's a joke on every way that we think about power and every way that we think about the world is supposed to be. The world is supposed to be fixed. And we're supposed to be in charge.
Yes. I think Anna's saying, too, how do we do this? And I think that up here, in my position, in our position, the question keeps being, how do we proclaim this? How do we keep proclaiming it? You know, I mean, it's just a constant need to keep living and keep proclaiming and keeping on, you know. And that's, I think, always the place where we stumble, because sometimes, I mean, we get off the wrong side of the bed or the wrong side of the bed.
I think I think proclaiming, you know, and talking about it, struggling to see it, and so on, it is obviously crucial. But you know, I thought we lived it yesterday. And all of a sudden, I'm feeling emotional about this. But when we talked about the pastor yesterday, and the way, I don't even know this man. I've never met Eric Holland, but I believe from listening that this man is a servant of the cross, and that the process by which we worked yesterday, that was theology of the cross in action, because we didn't say, by God, we're right and we're going to do this. We said, we need a person to come be with us and be our pastor, and we may get screwed over for this, but it's not about being a poster child for our rightness. This is about the service that needs to be done here, and somebody who can do it, and maybe we're going to get shat upon for it and sing in the urine, but...
Listen to us sing.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I thought I saw going on yesterday. In a kind of humble way, we were just living it.
I think one of the things I hear us struggling with is that it's what you were saying about needing doctrine to protect the good news as good. That sometimes when we do that, it sounds very much like we're saying we're right. And we're not saying we're right, we're saying chaos will prevail. But we don't just give in to every chaos and every whim of the spirit and every spirituality and every claim. We lean into this revealed word and we protect space for it so that it can kill us and raise us again. Because otherwise all the other louder voices will have their sway. And we have had moments like that around this table too. It was so hard to say all have sinned and fall short of the glory.
When you said that, there's a line in Romans that has haunted me for the last year. It's at the end of the 12th chapter. It says, "For God has made all humankind prisoners of disobedience, that his mercy may be extended to all." And then that's followed right away by that bit about, oh, the depths, the riches, the wonder of the knowledge of God. I think that whole dancing servant thing for me comes, I mean, that the knowledge that I am that kind of prisoner, you know, is in an odd way a cause for joy.
question of what do we do brought up a thought for me. I was someplace in the South and I found this little bumper, or not a bumper sticker, a little sticker that says, "What would Bubba do?" And I know the Bubba to my nieces and nephews. So I got one of those for each of my nieces and nephews. And I was having a discussion with Greta, my niece, and she said, "Oh, that's kind of like that. Don't they have those things that say, 'What would Jesus do?'" And I said, "Yeah." So that's kind of a play on that. She said, "Yeah, I've never figured out why those don't say, 'What would Jesus want me to do?'" And I just thought, you know, that here's the kid that she's about 13 at the time. It's not what would Jesus do. Yeah, that's important, but what would Jesus want me to do? And I think that's the question for me is, that's why I need to hear the theology over and over and over again to keep me centered on what it is that God wants me to do.
I think some of the hilarious seeing this whole thing is when, Fred, you're talking about the human need to be right is this dominant feature. And in theology of the cross, we never really get it right. But at the same time, I really want to be able to say, this is what I believe in, this is where I stand. But I really can't say that because this is where I am today, because I can't get it right. I'm never going to really be there. And when you have this theology of glory Christians, that they're so where they are, and we see, like, we're so wimpy because it's like, I find funny.
Yeah.
I can't get it right. I want to get it right, but I can't get it right. I'll never get there. And other people, they've got it right, and they're so solid in their stance.
My favorite creedal statement anymore is Luther's meaning to the third article, which has become not a piece of catechism anymore, but a deep piece of my faith. I believe that I cannot by my own reason or strength believe in Jesus Christ my Lord to come to him, but the Holy Spirit has called me by the gospel, and so on and so on and so on. If you take out all the qualifiers and so on, it's such a simple thing. I believe that I cannot believe, but... That's so true. And the big but is that the Holy Spirit never gives up. And the Christian faith is not that I can hang on to God, but that God hangs on to me.
Yeah, Fritz Norstedt used to say that was God's big but.
The divine barrier.
Well, Joe Sittler comments on that too when he was asked once, "What is a theologian? What was his where's his theological stance?" And he responded, "I have both feet firmly planted in midair."
Well, it's about 10 o'clock, and snacks have arrived, which I wasn't expecting.